the edge of our hope, at the end of our time. We have chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other. Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
Now get the hell out of our galaxy.
The strength of this starship lay in its diversity.
You see, our glorious diversity, that is not a threat to who we are. It makes us who we are.
You don't just let things happen. You make a stand. You say no. You have the guts to do what's right when everyone else just runs away.
But we must fight this darkness that is threatening to engulf us. Each of us must be a ray of hope.
Rebellions are built on hope.
Welcome to the Skippy and Fanti Show. I'm Stina, and today on Signal Boost, we have Nikki Drayden, systems analyst and author of The Prey of Gods. Welcome to the show, Nikki.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't you tell us about yourself and The Prey of Gods? It just came out from Harper Voyager, right?
It did. It just came out. It's been out almost exactly a month now, and it's been kind of a wild ride. Like you said, I'm a systems analyst by day, and I've been kind of writing by night in the wee hours of the morning, trying to make something happen of my creative process. And The Prey of Gods is my first novel, is my debut novel. And so I'm really excited to see it out there on the shelves. It's set in a futuristic South Africa that's brimming with demigods and sentient robots. There's genetic engineering. So pretty much a big giant mashup, genre mashup. And it follows several characters. It kind of is an interweaving thread of characters. We have a teenage boy who's kind of on the cusp between boyhood and manhood and trying to figure out things where he stands while he's gains these powers and he's suddenly able to control minds. So on top of, you know, your normal teenage, you know, everyday problems, you're also trying to figure out how to control, you know, your ability to control other people. And there's a little girl she lives in a township and she's kind of being neglected by her mother. And she's also coming into her own powers. And a pop diva who's made a lot of sacrifices to get to where she is and is now kind of having second thoughts. So all of these threads kind of tie together and they are going to have to rise up and defend their humanity against a demigoddess who's kind of hell-bent on reshaping humanity in the way that she thinks is most favorable, but probably most people would not agree with.
Cool. Who's your favorite character?
Oh, wow. I would secretly say Sydney, because she is kind of the antagonist of the story, but I have a soft spot for her, even though she's disemboweled a lot of people and has kind of a mean streak, but she's kind of a down to earth kind of person, or demigoddess. Like she's been holding several jobs to make ends meet. And so like, I admire her, you know, stick-to-itiveness and her work ethic and her ambitions, even if they're not quite aligned with what I think.
What's your favorite part of the novel?
Oh gosh. I would have to say, without giving too much away, that the climax of the novel is kind of crazy. It's been called banana pants a lot. I don't actually know what that means, but I think it's a good thing. I think just tying all these threads together of these, there's six different characters and trying to weave their, none of them really know each other at the beginning of the story. And so trying to weave that together and all kind of like builds together towards the climax. So you see how their paths cross throughout this story. So that was a lot of fun.
So which specific genres have you woven through on this thing?
I would say, what haven't I woven? I don't know. There's definitely fantasy and mythology, science fiction. There's a sentient robot. One of the characters is a sentient robot who's not supposed to be sentient. So it's trying to keep it a secret from everyone. There's dark humor, probably close to some parts are kind of horrific, I would say. And I don't know what other genres. There's a little bit of romance in there. I don't know. It's all in there, basically.
everything. So let's go a little back to the whole being a debut author thing. I've been there myself, obviously. Can you talk a little bit about your experience? Everyone's usually pretty interested in how a writer gets to where they are. And what's your story?
I've had a long story. I've been writing probably close to 15 years. And so, and kind of seriously, trying to get published and short stories published and that sort of thing. I just, for novel writing, it was like always my first love. That's how I started out writing novels, because I heard about National Novel Writing Month like way, way back when. And it sounded really cool, so I decided to give it a try. And I wrote my first novel, and like since then, I was hooked. And so I started, you know, going to different writers groups and that sort of thing. And I also went to the Armadillocon Writers Workshop and try to like hone my craft and get better and better and make connections. And so finally, I was at the point where I had a manuscript and I started querying it. And I lucked out. I don't know how this happened, but I got this awesome agent, Jennifer Jackson. And like, I was like, wow, I've made it. And so this was like in 2011. And so like, I knew like she was going to, you know, sell this book right away. And so we had like some nibbles and, you know, some interest, but never, you know, a solid offer or anything like that. So, you know, 1 year went by and 2 years went by and 3 years went by. And at that point, like I kept writing and I wasn't obsessing about it or anything like that. But I was like, well, you know, that book didn't hit, but you know, then definitely the next one will, because I'm just a very optimistic person.
Well, good for you. A lot of people I know would have quit at that point.
A lot of agents would have quit at that point too, but she kept pushing. And finally, it was almost 4 years when like we got a call from Harper Voyager and David Pomerico. I talked to him on the phone and he was really, you know, ecstatic about the novel and had a good vision for it. So I felt really good about it. And the next day, like, I ended up getting an offer. And so all of a sudden, like this long process, like started happening like very fast. And then you have like deadlines and like, you know, various edits. You have to read your book a million times. And it's just like, it's been crazy ever since, basically.
Oh man, that's incredible. I'm a big fan of beginning writers having that near miss, because I personally feel that if you have the experience of failing early on and then overcoming it, then I feel like you're stronger when you go through this whole debut author process, because it is so intense and just crazy, you know? And that way, when things inevitably happen, because life happens, you already realize you've already gone through things that would be considered as quote unquote failures or whatever. You know you can recover from it. And so I feel like that makes you stronger as a person.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think a little adversity kind of helps a little bit.
Yeah. So I have to say this. Your cover is awesome.
Thank you very much.
I absolutely love that cover. It is brilliant. It is so engaging. Also, okay, so what's been the biggest challenge as a debut author for you?
I think just juggling everything, because suddenly like you're running a small business. And if you have not run a small business before, it's kind of a rude awakening. So you have, you know, a lot of stuff coming at you. You're doing interviews, you know, you're trying to get reviewers and interact with your fans or try to grow your fan base and trying to find ways to do all these sorts of things to make your book a success. And a lot of these things don't involve like your fiction writing. So that's been kind of a hard balance to try to find time to, you know, actually get back to writing the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but I feel like it's sort of starting to settle down now, and I look forward to, you know, writing more.
Cool. What's been your favorite part?
I did a book launch team, and I had a lot of, you know, friends and family get together and, you know, try to organize into this kind of collective force to help kind of propel the book forward and, you know, get a little bit of visibility from that. And that was fun, just, you know, interacting with friends and trying to get everybody excited about things and seeing how everybody was excited and supporting me. And it's just kind of like a month long party. And I don't know, I thought it was really fun. Definitely would do it again.
Cool. Is there anything else about your book you would like to talk about?
I think it's kind of a crazy read if you like kind of crazy and entertaining characters and pushing the boundaries of belief, maybe. I'm just engaging in plot devices in a different setting than what you might be used to, I think. And you like crude jokes, I think it might be up your alley.
Cool. Okay. I wanted to bring up one of the things you've been working on the side is the scholarship program for Black writers to attend ArmadilloCon and the Writers Workshop. Can you tell our listeners a little about that and where to find more information?
Sure. Let's see. I guess, you know, I've been attending ArmadilloCon for years now, and it's, you know, one of my favorite places. I go there and I feel like, you know, I found my tribe. There's been a lot of talk, you know, lately about, you know, diversifying your writing and like diversifying things. I'm like, well, we also need to, you know, diversify the people who are attending the convention. And, so, you know, not just talk about things. So, I set out, you know, I figured, you know, trying to increase visibility and get, you know, the workshop in front of people of color to know, even know that it exists so that they can come attend. And as an added incentive, you know, we would be able to sponsor their seat for the workshop. And I think did pretty good this year. We got a good turnout. And so hopefully we'll be able to continue it. We are using, I guess, TurkeyCity.org is the website, I believe, to kind of just raise awareness in general of writing, you know, around the Central Texas area, with a focus on, you know, trying to support underrepresented groups who are doing speculative fiction. And hopefully, you know, if we start, you know, where the pipeline starts, you know, 5 years from now, we'll be seeing a rise in the number of published authors of color. And hoping everyone gets to spread their voice and say whatever they have to say.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think I absolutely agree with you. Okay, so in that case, let us know where you can find you and your book online.
Sure. You can find me most actively on Twitter. My handle's at Nikki Drayden. I sometimes blog very infrequently. If you go to NikkiDrayden.com. I have a newsletter. Just sent out my first newsletter today. I'm trying to highlight some of the books I've read recently that I found really entertaining. And on Facebook, I am also Nikki Drayden. So those are my main avenues of contact.
Wow, you actually do a newsletter.
I'm doing a newsletter. I like reading newsletters.
Good for you.
People do too.
Yeah, I'm terrible because I just the whole idea of putting together a newsletter and then just gives me the hive. I'm terrible. Anyway, thank you for joining us, Nikki Drayden, for telling us about The Prey of God. Thank you, listeners, for joining us on Signal Boost. Go check out Nikki's work, and I hope you have a good afternoon.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show. I'm Jen, and today on Signal Boost, we have Wendy Wagner. Wendy is the managing/associate editor of Lightspeed and Nightmare magazines, the author of more than 30 short stories and 2 Pathfinder novels, and of course, the reason that we are here today, her new novel, Oath of Dogs, out from Angry Robot Books. Welcome to the show, Wendy.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really cool.
It's my pleasure. So let's dive right into everything. Give me all the details on Oath of Dogs, or at least the ones that aren't going to spoil everything for your readers.
Well, An Oath of Dogs is about a woman. Her name is Kate Standish, but she freaks out if you call her Kate. She only likes to be called Standish. And she and her therapeutic companion animal, a dog named Hattie, move to a new planet. It's the first new planet that people have really started to colonize, so it's kind of new and exciting, although people have been there for about 100 years now. And she's got a job all lined up to basically, you know, like, be the cable lady for a big, big multi-international conglomerate. And when she gets there, she discovers that the really nice guy that hired her is already dead. He died while she was in transit. And so she, hooray, she got promoted just by driving.
Gotta love when that works out.
However, things begin to be revealed, and she starts to suspect that perhaps Duncan Chambers, the man who hired her, was murdered, and she thinks that the company might have something to do with it. So she's the main character, she and Hattie, the cool. I really like Hattie. I think she's, if you like animals, if you like dogs, Hattie is like maybe the best part of the whole book, just because she's like a super awesome hero dog. But there's also another point of view character. His name is Dr. Peter Bajowski, and he is a biologist who works for the same giant multinational corporation, which is kind of tough for him because he's becoming, as he lives on this planet, more than a little bit of an environmentalist. And when you work for a multinational conglomerate that works in extraction agent industries like mining and logging, it's not really very pro-environmental activism.
No, it really isn't, sadly.
No. So, and he used to go out with Duncan, the dead guy, so he has a vested interest in figuring out what happened to him. So together they sort of pal up to solve this mystery.
That sounds exciting.
I had a great time working through it. It's also really fun because the planet that they're on has a lot of really cool creatures and really cool plants. Most things on the planet come in either super green. It rains a lot, actually almost nonstop on this planet. So it's got like that really dense jungly forest going on, but it's cold. So it's more like
Pacific Northwest.
Yes, why? It's almost as if I live in the Pacific Northwest and it's fond of the forests and trees.
No, crazy talk. That was actually one of my questions, because I know you grew up in Oregon, and this kind of sounds to me like you're drawing very much on your experiences of growing up in Oregon and the fact that Oregon has a very rich logging history. And I was curious, just apart from, you know, that being where you're from and write what you know, so to speak, but why you went with kind of a blue collar perspective for a novel set in space.
Well, you know, a lot of it is because of my childhood. My dad actually was a logger. And we lived in, we lived just outside of a town that had not just a paper mill, but also a lumber mill. And everyone I knew, their parents worked for some kind of company that was doing stuff with turning trees into other products. And this was the late 80s, early 90s, right at the time when, you know, scientists are beginning to say, there's this bird called the spotted owl. And you know what? We're going to put it on the endangered species list because the fact that it's dying off is actually indicative of just how unhealthy the forests in the Northwest have become. And it was a really tense time to be growing up in that area. There were environmental activists that would, you know, chain themselves to trees, and people would set fires to logging sites, and loggers were constantly, you know, belittling environmental activists, and everybody was scared that there would be no jobs. And of course, I was a total tree hugger, like a literal honest to God tree hugger. Like, I would come home from school and I would go talk to the trees around my house. And if it had been a bad day at school, I would, yes, hug them. So I just always felt extremely like I didn't belong in this place because you know, I didn't want, you know, the bumper sticker says, I love spotted owls fried. And I was like, but spotted owls are so cute. I just want to hug one.
Me too. I grew up in a similar sort of environment, which was a former logging town, Santa Cruz, California, but similar environment in terms of just the biology of the place. And we used to vacation in Oregon in the 90s. And even just vacationing, you could see that tension that was going on. It was in the newspapers. It was everywhere. So I was really fascinated by that perspective taken to, you know, another planet. It makes sense to me.
I mean, I work in science. I've always loved science fiction and fantasy. It's just where my brain goes. And I tend to think of it as being the perfect genre to handle allegory and to deal with philosophical issues. And so that's one of the reasons why I really enjoy working in the field. And so I thought that to tell like a story that still connected to a lot of these things that I felt were really important about my youth and my childhood, I just couldn't write just another like, and the starship winged through space with aliens shooting behind it. You know, I couldn't write that book. So I had to write a book that was loggers in space.
I'm very excited about the perspective of, like I said, more a blue collar point of view, even though clearly you're dealing with a scientist and what is Standish exactly? The cable girl?
Yeah, basically. I mean, her job title is communications manager, but basically she goes around and, you know, sets up cable connecting people's, you know, phone systems and wireless communications.
That sounds awesome. Tell me more. Why intelligent dogs in your world?
Well, you know, the origin of this book, first I thought it would be a short story, a short fantasy story. But the more I chipped at the problem, the bigger and weirder it got. I wanted to write about the way we relate to dogs, because in human history, humans have had a really complicated relationship to dogs. Nowadays, pretty much every dog you see is going to be somebody's pet or maybe a working dog. But, you know, if you look at older texts, a lot of places were really, they struggled with wild dogs. Like there are even passages in the Bible where they talk about how, you know, wild dogs would eat the dead. And there's a book. I can't say that I love this book. I wouldn't say I hated it. There's a horror novel called A Winter's Haunting by Dan Simmons. And one of the characters goes into some of the things about dogs and their history. And when I was reading this book years ago, it was when I was working on my first Pathfinder novel, it got me really thinking about how we love dogs, but how dogs can be dangerous. And I wanted to create a situation where we had to talk about what we mean when we talk about dogs and why it is when somebody is terrible, you say he's a dirty dog, and yeah, why dogs are man's best friend and things like that.
That makes sense. I mean, they do say that we've basically co-evolved with what, dogs and horses?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective to look at. One of the reviews on the book mentioned that there's sort of an uneasy peace between the environmentalists, or not necessarily an uneasy peace, but that at a certain point, especially when you're looking at another planet, governments, companies, and local people and environmentalists have to work together. Can you talk a little bit more about putting that perspective into the book?
Well, I mean, I am really, really, I am super conscious of environmental issues. But as someone who grew up in a mill town, I knew sort of, you know, the human background of how economies develop in these places. And so for me, that was one of the most important things, was to try to show that the people living and working on this planet, even if they're advocating policies that, to me, as a conservationist, are kind of horrible. But they still make perfect sense to the people who live there, and they are important survival and coping skills for people who live in an environment that can be difficult and harsh, and you know, it's hard to make a living in a new place. A lot of the ideas I had about the social and political structure, I think, really came from just historical stuff about the ways our own country developed. You know, we were a colony of a much larger, much more of this, you know, really economically powerful entity. And so just kind of seeing like what happened when they made the United States just really kind of fed into the book. I don't know if that answered the question at all or if I got sidetracked.
It did, absolutely. Thank you.
Oh, good.
So I'm also very, you mentioned your Pathfinder novels. How was making the jump from a essentially pre-built world of Pathfinder to making your own fully evolved planet?
Well, you know, I've written a lot of short stories over the years. That's actually, this year it's gone up to 41. And I think for every short story I've created, with the exception of the ones I've written for Pathfinder, and one that I wrote that was set on the same planet as Oath of Dogs, in general, just to write a story, I usually have to do a lot of world building. I feel like a world usually comes into my head, and I have to flesh it out quite a bit before I can even write, you know, a 20-page short. So I felt like I already had quite a lot of world building experience there. And when writing in Pathfinder, Galarian, that's the world that the game is set in, it has all kinds of creatures and things like that. But at the same time, a lot of what the world is coming out of the writer's brain. You know, I had all this reference material that they gave me, but it still didn't go into what kinds of rocks were there, what kinds of plants are there. You know, all of that was really up to me. So I really love making up worlds to escape to. So for me, getting to make up this world was magnificently fun. And I did draw a lot from the places that I know well. And actually there are a few little fun things like in the town that are actual references to kind of real places around Portland. So it was just kind of fun to mix up what I knew about the real world with like these rules I had established for that reality, and just to charge straight into my own brain.
So, second to last but not least, what is the one most important thing that you want prospective buyers of this book to know about it?
The most important thing to know about it when they buy it? Oh, that's a tough call. I think they should know that, you know, it's got a lot of, like, thrilling and kind of scary action in it. So it's a mystery, but it's also, I would say it's mostly a thriller. So prepare to, you know, be tingled with excitement.
Yay! I am preparing myself, for sure. And then, last but not least, please tell everybody where they can find you and Oath of Dog.
Well, you can find me, my website is winniewoohoo.com. I'm also over at Twitter. My handle there is WN Wagner. And you can find Oath of Dogs at any of finer bookstore, such as Powell's, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. And I think a lot of local bookstores will have it too.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Wendy.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
It was my pleasure. So thank you, listeners, for checking us out again on Signal Boost. And now go check out Oath of Dog. Bye-bye.
thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show, and on Patreon at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. Our intro and outro music comes from The Launch by Chronux. You can find out more about their music at freemusicarchive.org.